They're your Lost fan, right? Yeah. I had a professor in seminary who taught Old Testament, and he was saying how much he lamented sermon titles and how he thought they were so stupid. And if he was a pastor, they have these signboards outside of traditional churches that sometimes have these phrases like, you think it's hot here, try dot, 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 and then they'll have the sermon title for next week or whatever. And he said, if I was the pastor of a church, if we're talking about Judges 12, that would be the sign. It says, this week, come here, if we're talking about Judges 12. And I thought, yeah, that'll pack them in. But I always tend to think, I either have, generally, what I find are lousy or uncreative sermon titles, or I have ones that are evocative and creative and may or may not have anything to do with the sermon itself because I thought it up a couple weeks beforehand. So, but if you're a Lost fan, you'll recognize this from Jack's speech, we live together or we'll die alone, which is a pretty pivotal and kind of determinative moment, in their life together on the island, which we still don't know what the deal with it is. But it frustrated me so much. This is an Andy Rooney moment. I felt like the whole last season was next week, all your questions will be answered. And in the end, I was like, I don't even really know what the deal with Walt was. And that's not even a big question. I felt like none of my questions were answered. Anyway, still a great show. It's no Battlestar Galactica, but... before we get into Ruth, I just want to spend a minute or two putting it in context, because it's a book that is a story that may be familiar to some of you, but for many of you, it might be really unfamiliar. I mean, I think as you read it, and I think what Matt said bears listening to and attending to, everything Matt says bears listening to, but particularly that. It's a short book, and what's great is you could sit and read it last week driving to church, I had the Bible on CDs, and I listened to it 2.5 times, just driving in the car. So it's pretty easy to familiarize yourself with. It's a great narrative, and it's a narrative in which I think in this little narrative, you can see some of the great overarching themes of the whole biblical story, right? Because that's what makes the Bible, right? It's all these different types of literature with all these different authors coming together under the inspiration of one Spirit. And with all this diversity, there's unity at the heart of it. And it's part of one big epic story, and Ruth is a part of that. A couple weeks ago, we did getting with John Olaf and Matt, and I did this seminar on learning the biblical story. And Matt had this great slide, which I just borrowed, that you could think of the biblical story as having several episodes. If you were thinking of a play, this would be a multi-act play here. But Genesis, the creation story, the flood. This is that Seinfeld, I'm not so familiar with you priests, but I know the general outline. The flood, the lepers. Now you have creation, you have Genesis 1 through 11, which scholars call the primeval history, this ancient epic time. The covenant, the call of Abraham. The Exodus, of course, where the children of Egypt, who, as Abraham's family becomes larger and larger, becomes enslaved in Egypt, they're delivered. We have the history, which covers a big chunk between Israel's being delivered. They're going into the land. They're existing as almost a loose confederation of tribes and people, and they're uniting under a monarchy and becoming a great kingdom, and then dissolving into two kingdoms, and then eventually going into exile. Then there's Jesus, the Jesus event, which is God's returning to the temple, really, to God's returning in a new, deep way, and ending the people's exile. And then there's mission, the time that the story that we exist in, the sending of God's people to continue in the power of the Spirit to live out and bear witness to the story of Jesus for the sake of the world. And then there's the hope we await for, the return of Christ, to consummate, to finish what he started, and to make all things new, where there'll be no more crying and no more dying. Now, Ruth comes to us in the history section. Ruth takes place in the time of the judges. Sometime around 1100 BC, right? Sometime around 1100, which is, again, during the time of the judges, after Israel has been liberated from bondage in Egypt, but before they become a kingdom, before they become united into a monarchy, right? So this is a time where, if you know the book of Judges at all, the judges are not like Judge Wapner or Judge Judy, right? I mean, that's not primarily what they do. They're more like people that bring God's judgment and deliverance for the people. So when God's people are in need, God will raise up someone like Deborah or someone like Samson, who will act as the person who will deliver God's judgment, be the mediator of God's redemptive activity amidst the people. But it's a time that was not the greatest period in Israel's history, right? There's this refrain that happens several times in Judges. It says that in those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. It was a time of cultural unrest and instability. And as we said, it's this period between the entrance into the land and the establishment of the monarchy. Now, there's something that Ruth, if you read it, you'll notice something. I think almost immediately, at least after you read it, if you read it twice, this will definitely not escape you. Even if you read it once carefully, you'll probably notice this. God never speaks. There's not one utterance of the Lord. There's not even a prophetic utterance. There's no miracles. There's no sensation. This would be tough. This is not what Disney makes a movie out of, right? You can squeak by with Prince of Egypt, but there is probably a reason there are no Disney epics about Ruth. No superbook, yeah, which Christian nerdy culture, if you've been in the... No, I'm just kidding. I had one superbook video I got from my friend Tommy Bachman, but yeah, I like the one video I had. But what's interesting is Ruth is such an utterly mundane story at some levels, right? And yet, I think that in the midst of epic stories, there are often mundane parts, right? I think of Star Wars, right? Like, you figure, you know, in Star Wars, and now I'm thinking Episode 4, okay? It used to be you could just say Star Wars, but now you have to say, like, Episode 1, 2, 3. I'm thinking the old Star Wars, the good one, with Harrison Ford and with George Hamill or whatever. I remember thinking about this scene in the 1978 Star Wars, I'll say it that way, or 1980 or whatever. There's this scene. Does anybody remember the scene? Luke is sitting with his Uncle Owen and his aunt, what was her name? Beru. What a great name. I can't believe more kids aren't named that, you know? Beru. You guys think about daughter. Daughters, everybody's pregnant. Baby shower. Think about Beru if it's a girl. And they're talking about Luke leaving the farm on Tatooine to go to the academy. And as they begin talking about it, you hear this. It's this very mundane scene, right? It's just like, I mean, you all probably have had these conversations with family members, like when you're an adolescent and you want to do things, it's not the right time, you're sort of dickering about plans and details. It's the sort of everyday stuff of normal life. And then all of a sudden there's this kind of do, 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 like right in the middle of the conversation, right? And I think that's George Lucas's way of telling us that there's something more here than the mundane, even though it's in the midst of the mundane. It's right in the thick of it. And yet that somehow the mundane table conversation that's going on at Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru's table here with Luke is actually part of a drama that's bigger than any of the participants could ever imagine. I think that's exactly what the Book of Ruth is like. right? There's all these mundane scenes, and it's a condensed narrative, right? But these mundane scenes where there's no miracles, there are not plagues or locusts or lepers healed or anything like that. There's no pillar of fire. You know, there's a denomination called Pillar of Fire. I actually wanted to change that just so, like, people say, what denomination? POF, Pillar of Fire. There's no pillar of fire. There's none of this sort of things. But that doesn't mean that it's any less a part of the epic of redemption. The fact that there are not these things like we see in the book of Exodus or even in Judges in the same time period, this is no less a part of the mysterious workings of God's healing of the world. There's a great quote I came across by a scholar named Barry Webb who summarizes this really well, I think. It, and he's talking about Ruth, contains no miraculous interventions by God, no inspired prophetic interpreters or spokespersons, and no events involving Israel as a whole. The story is entirely domestic and local in character, and the divine workings in it are hidden and providential. They lie beneath the surface rather than on it. It shows us that those whom God saves by signs and wonders, as at the Exodus, he continues to save by providential workings in their day-to-day lives. And that his kindness, by which Israel is built up, is to be found not only in great national deliverances, but in the way his covenant people treat one another on a daily basis. It is micro as opposed to macro salvation history. I found that really encouraging when I read it because I think most of us live our lives, most of us, I would guess, without tons of dramatic divine interventions. That most of the time, the way God will work is micro salvation history in our lives. Most of the time, the way our stories will become bound up with the story of Jesus are in very mundane and ordinary ways. And it's comforting to know that, as we'll see as we get into Ruth, this Ruth is central to the whole unfolding of the story of Jesus. And yet, her story is, the story of her and Naomi, are so, in many ways, unremarkable. And yet, they're part of a remarkable epic tale. So with that being said, let's pray for a minute, will we? God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing in your sight. Lord, you who are our rock and our redeemer. Amen. I think there are a few things that we see in this narrative. There are a few, like, phases that develop. The story begins with a desperate departure. Then we see a wave of deaths. Then, following that wave of deaths, we see a parting of ways. And lastly, we hear, I think, the sound of silence. So first, the desperate departure. You'll notice that the story begins you get all these names, right, of the people in the story, which is really interesting because when you tell a parabolic tale that's like mythical, you don't often get names, right, because the characters are just sort of archetypes, right, for ideas. But that's not the case here. These are real people involved in the everyday course of history with real problems and problems that are really of a tragic and scary proportion. The occasion for this dramatic departure is famine. There's famine in the land. And it's hard for us, I think, as people in an affluent modern society to empathize with famine because we're mobile and our food sources are mobile. And so even if we're in tough economic times as individuals, we still live in a pretty blessed system where, you know, you can grow up as a kid just thinking that strawberries grow in a refrigerated shelf. And we spend a tremendous amount of energy and resources shipping things all over the place. There was a woman who wrote a book where I heard her interviewed on NPR where she spent an entire year just eating locally. think about how your life would be different if you just had to wait till spring to get a strawberry or peach or summer. And in winter, you had to eat what you stored up. And she talked about the dramatic impact it had on her family. Right? So when food sources are local and famine comes, one obvious solution, right, is to go someplace else to get food. And so I think, like, we can empathize here, right? Like, we, maybe not from our existential situation, but we can think if we were back in that situation and didn't have at our disposal the ability to just have a truck bring us more food because we can't farm today, you know, we might do this too. But what's interesting is where Naomi's family chooses to go. A decision, my guess, is Naomi probably didn't have a huge say. It was a patriarchal culture, right? But where do they go? They go to Moab, which is a neighboring land, and where the Moabites live. I guess you don't have to be a great biblical scholar to figure that out, right? Moabites, Moab. It's interesting, though. Moab was actually a person, right, from whom a people descended, and his father was Lot, right? And so for some of you that are familiar with the book of Genesis and its sort of major events, after Abraham rescues Lot, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, after he intercedes on his nephew Lot's behalf, and Lot is spared God's judgment on this wicked place that for Ezekiel 16:49 tells us the sin of Sodom, right? They were haughty, overfed, and forsook the poor. This oppressive place that is seemingly almost completely bereft of the kind of kindness that we see in the book of Ruth. God judges it, but Lot is spared, and Lot winds up, his wife, it actually turns into a pillar of salt. Right, as she looks back, Lot's told, don't look back. She looks back. So Lot is left with his two daughters. They actually, and this is like a weird and sort of sordid story. His daughters actually get him drunk and sleep with him to get impregnated. And Moab is the fruit of that event. We have this drunken act of desperation because they wanted children and a line to give them social protection, right? Which I think, so, and then the Moabites continue in the Old Testament, right, as people that are kind of a thorn in Israel's side up to this point. So they're a group of people that are not friends of the people of God. It's a country, it's a place that wouldn't, for any ancient Israelite, evoke, oh gosh, where would we look for help? Moab. The Moabites, you know, great people. And yeah, it's interesting, right? As you read the story that gives birth, literally, to the Moabites, and this story, you see something in common, right? Desperation. Lot's daughters are desperate because they're facing really harsh circumstances. Naomi's family, her husband, is, and sons, they're facing desperate times. There's that old saying, right? Desperate times call for desperate measures. A lot of times, too, desperate times produce less than reflective responses. And sometimes when times are desperate, we will get disoriented. That when things are good, when we have this real strong sense, God's on the throne, gosh, things are great, you know, what a great world where the just get rewarded, the unjust get punished, right? That it's relatively easier to make measured decisions that reflect our best intuition and wisdom. But when things get disorienting and chaotic, oftentimes we get disoriented. There's actually a phenomenon that pilots who get in deep cloud cover, early pilots that gain their license, they're novice, because they can't see, And because they're up in a different sort of place, like literally high up in the air, and they're just learning to fly, you know, they tend to not trust the instruments, and they can't see. And so they're in this cloud cover, and they're making tiny adjustments. The instruments can't be right. The instruments can't be right. They're making and all of a sudden, numbers of pilots, I've heard, in this early stage, in deep cloud cover, come out of the cover flying upside down, and they didn't know it. Because they're in this disorienting time that's stressful and hard. And, you know, you don't think you're making bad decisions. You're making quick decisions, right? And all of a sudden, you make a quick little judgment. Nah, it can't be. I know what my eye, that can't be right. And all of a sudden, they're flying upside down and don't know how they got there. At what point was I upside down? Right? You know, you don't feel it. It's a gradual transition, right? Like they say, it's like the frog and the kettle analogy, right? They say, I mean, I've never done this because I'm not sadistic, but I mean, they say, right, that if you throw a frog in boiling water, it will hop right out. But if you put a frog in a kettle and just turn the heat on, that it will boil and die. Because sometimes in desperate times where things get disorienting and confusing and we forget just how we got there, we lose our compass. We lose the sense of true north. And I think that it's not by any accident the author begins the story saying it's the time of judges. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes. It was a time of general disorientation and confusion. And here we see an act of disorientation and confusion. Of which Naomi is probably, you know, maybe, I'm sure even in patriarchal society, husbands and wives talked and stuff at dinner tables and whatnot, but she certainly didn't make the decision, right? But she may have contributed, we don't know. And of course, that leads us to the next part of the story, right? They're in the land of the Moabites, and we see this tragic wave of deaths. We read that her husband dies, and she's left there with her two sons who take Moabite wives. Now, there's no, the laws on marrying Moabites are ambiguous. I mean, they're not, it's not something in the Hebrew legislative tradition that's explicitly forbidden, and yet it's also not looked at pleasantly. So here you have the husband, a result of this situation, right? This, which arose because of a response to this desperate famine rising up. You see these sons who marry Moabite women, they die. So that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Now, on one level, just reading the story, you can think, okay, like, does the narrator think we're, like, stupid? Like, of course, it's not a very long story, and he just told us that she had the husband and the sons, and now they're dead. Does he have to repeat that, like, does he think we have ADD and we're not paying attention or something? I think it's for dramatic emphasis because here, the physical deaths lead to a social death. She now faces the prospect of being a nobody, of being like undead. This is funny because I just got into, this is horrible, but like I've watched two of the, what is that movie now? I can't think of it. Where the woman hunts the zombies. Resident Evil. I've watched two of them. It's horrible. I'm a bad person. This is horrible, but I've watched two of them. But it's really interesting, our culture's fascination with zombies right now. But you think about what's tragic about a zombie, it's undead. It's this reality of you're not alive, and yet you're no longer inanimate. You have this motion, and you're sort of, people fear you, and you don't move like a normal human, and people askew you, and yet you still try to eat and do things that humans do, and you do them in these ways that are gross and perverse. You face this prospect of being undead as a zombie, right? And this is why people say, what happens when somebody gets bit in any of these movies, right? Kill me now, you know? And of course, nobody can do it. And then later in the movie, they go, I would never eat you. Ah! You know, the person turns, right? And you think, we should have shot them. That was further than I wanted to go with the analogy, but but she faces the prospect of being an undead, of being socially dead, of being someone who walks and yet is dead. Now, we think, gosh, that's so regressive, right? Like, just because a woman doesn't have sons or a husband, that she's undead and socially dead. And I mean, gosh, what sort of regressive patriarchal norms. But here's the thing. Every culture has undead. Every culture has nobodies. Every culture has people that walk and breathe and share your space that you look through as if they don't. Right? Now, it may not be because you have, like in Naomi's cultural context, right? For us, maybe you come from a family with a great name and great social relations, right? But that's not enough for you because you don't have individual achievement, right? You don't have the story of the self-made man or woman because we're an individualistic culture. With Naomi, it's the opposite way, right? It doesn't matter how great you are as an individual because your identity is largely rooted in community. And I'm not saying one is better than the other, but in every culture, because it's finite and fallen and bears the scars of our first parent's sin, will tend to take norms and preferences and make them absolute and render them as judgments and make you a nobody. Thinking about this, like, and just how subtle it can be, like, I think Marilyn Monroe was like a size 14, wasn't she? Right? Now, or 16? Now, she would be a plus-size model today. So at one point, the previous generation's standard of beauty, and the next generation is the plus-size model, right? So our standards for exclusion vary, and sometimes they vary just by generation. Sometimes they vary now by trend, right? Whatever's trending on Twitter, but our culture always makes undead. Cultures always produce living dead. People that, because of their social situations, because of their social relations or lack thereof, because of who they are in people's eyes, become people that aren't fully alive. And certainly that's how Naomi feels. Naomi can read the writing on the wall. She knows what's happened to her and what tragic events will likely ensue as a result of her status. Then we see a parting of ways. We hear Naomi say something really interesting. "It is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me," she says to her daughters. "That the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Now, it's interesting. We don't read that in the text, do we? We don't read that God has judged her. Right? We don't read that what's befallen her is because of some deep-seated sin in her life. No, certainly the author probably is telling us that going to Moab in a famine is probably not the greatest idea for somebody who's trying to be a light to the nations, right? And maybe needs to internalize more of the Torah before they go as missionary people or something. Maybe, yeah, but is this really, did she have a sort of key role in that decision? One of the commentators says this, and it's worth quoting at length here. "While the text has only subtly alluded to this fact, and the reader may not have fully recognized it, Naomi makes it abundantly clear that, at least in her understanding, the earlier famine in Bethlehem, her family's sojourn in Moab, the deaths of her husband and her sons, and the barrenness of her daughters-in-law are all evidences of God's hand as the cause of her hardships. She feels that she is the target of God's overwhelming power and wrath. That God is actively behind these events will be affirmed throughout the story. that he is punishing Naomi, at least as Naomi feels is the case, is not necessarily correct. God is not out to get her. The fact that God is providentially has a hand in what's going on doesn't mean that hand is a backhand meant to abuse her. But see, it's a subtle temptation we all have, right? I think that when events unfold that are hard and tragic, I think a temptation is to look at them and say, God doesn't just have some mysterious hand in these events. It's the backhand, and it's meant to slap me. It's reached out to choke me. That this is God's judgment on me. I think that's not the case. But Naomi thinks it's the case. But what's remarkable is, thinking that's the case, she is still capable of a radical act of kindness. She's still capable of self-sacrificial love, even in a moment which may seem to border on a little bit of almost a narcissistic kind of judgment, like, hey, everyone's against me, the whole world, even God's against me right now. Which, understandable when hard circumstances unfold. I'm sure we all have felt that way. But even in the midst of that, she's capable of getting out of self-absorption and saying, go away from me. Why? Because she knows she's undead. She knows she's undead, and she knows that to bring her Moabite daughters-in-law with her to Israel, where she's heard the Lord has returned and brought some food, to Bethlehem, to bring them back here would condemn them. It would very possibly condemn them to be widows like her, people that wouldn't marry again. And see, Naomi is in the situation where she's not just a widow, she's an old widow, so her parents are dead. And so she has no sort of social location to link herself to protect her. She has no extended family. So she's going to be like a beggar, a panhandler. She's going to be someone that will just have no societal means to sustain her. And she's saying, look, if you could go back to your parents' house, who are presumably still alive, you could marry, you could stay rooted in your own culture, and the Lord could bless you for the kindness you've shown me. I know you want to stay with me, but you have to go. I can't have you do this. I can't bring my curse that's fallen on me on you. And I'm sure she also knows that her countrymen, despite the fact that they're God's chosen people, that doesn't mean they're always God's choice people. I'm sure she knows the potential harsh racism they'll feel. So she tries to set them free. It's an incredibly moving act. And Orpah acquiesces, one of her daughter-in-laws. And we shouldn't judge her too harshly. Right? I mean, I don't think Naomi was trying to say, okay, let's see, loyalty test now. This is real kindness. And one of the daughter-in-laws receives it and goes. But the other doesn't. I love that phrase, right? Orpah kisses her, but Ruth clings to her. There's a clinging here. Ruth returns a radical sacrificial act with a radical sacrificial act. One gives birth to the other. It's really interesting to see, right? This is sort of, I guess, Christianity 101, but we see it in the Old Testament. We see it all over. What's the most powerful act of Christian witness? What's the most powerful evangelistic word you can speak? Radical kindness and love and sacrifice. Here, I mean, we have no sense that Ruth has drunk in the wisdom of the scriptures or something. She could go back to the familiarity of her homeland and maybe begin anew. She chooses not to, though. She chooses to yoke herself not just to, notice, Naomi, but to Naomi's God. That she will revisit this radical act of embrace with another embrace. You know, it's so, I mean, some of you, I don't know if anybody here is an immigrant. Some of you certainly have someone in your family, probably because we're a land of immigrants, that is an immigrant, or have a close friend that's an immigrant. And why do we immigrate? Why do people immigrate? For a better life, for the prospect of a better life, right? That's why being an immigrant is so challenging, so disorienting. Why do you do it? You undertake that challenge to have a better life. But Ruth is willing to become an immigrant for the prospect of a worse life. She's willing to, it's interesting, she's willing to do something radically disorienting consciously because of a sacrificial act. Which brings us to the sound of silence. I love that title of the Simon and Garfunkel song, right? And who, if you've seen The Graduate, you can remember, right, when that song was playing and Dustin Hoffman is leaving, is coming back from college and standing on the escalator, right? When we're in a place like Naomi, I think the most debilitating thing can be our inner dialogues. And sometimes they're out loud, sometimes they're not, but they're personal dialogues. Sometimes they're interior, sometimes they become a monologue. You hear somebody, you know, God's against me, everyone's against me. And it seems self-effacing and humble, but really it oftentimes conceals what I think is almost the ultimate form of pride. Because part of pride is like, there's no one like me, right? I'm the exceptional case. And so we think of pride as the person that says, there's no one like me in a positive sense, right? That overexerts themselves. But there's another flip side of it, right? Underexertion, right? I'm nobody. I'm the singular case for a negative reason. I'm the only unlovable one. I'm the only person that can't be forgiven. I'm the only person whose story is irredeemable. Right? And you say that enough times and you'll believe it. That's because when our heart is broken, it cries out. And oftentimes when we're in desolate places, the worst thing we can do is to listen to ourselves, to listen to our heart cry. Martin Lloyd-Jones, the great British preacher of the 20th century, early 20th, mid-20th century, has a great book called Sermons on Spiritual Depression. And in it early on, he says, when you're going through these dark times, you've got to talk to yourself, not listen to yourself. Don't listen to the cries of your wounded and wandering heart and desolate heart. Preach the gospel to yourself. But we're not always capable of that, right? We're just not always capable of that. Yet what's interesting is Naomi is still spiritually astute enough to not be totally self-absorbed. And yet, out of the same mouth can come this exhortation to her daughter-in-laws to leave her, to save themselves. Out of that same mouth where she's concerned for them comes the self-damning of herself. What stops it? Ruth's radical act of kindness. What stops the damning monologue of Naomi is to hear a different word, to see it embodied. It's really interesting. The fruit of her evangelism is to be re-evangelized. The fruit of her witness is to be called to higher and deeper conversion. That's why it's important to be really, I think, in spiritual community, humble, because oftentimes maybe it's your spiritual children, right, that for you as a spiritual parent, someone that you've sort of brought into the faith, that will wind up offering you some deep spiritual truths in moments you don't see them coming. She said no more. And they went together. I have a friend, Peter Lighthart, who is about the best biblical interpreter I know. And he wrote this about Ruth, about the opening chapter. Ruth begins tragically. Elimelech flees from famine in Bethlehem by taking his wife and sons to Moab, where death assaults them. First, Elimelech dies, and Naomi is left with her two sons. Then her sons die, and she is left with only her daughters-in-law. But the movement of the chapter is not tragic. It's not a tragedy. It begins in famine, but ends in harvest. And the central turning point of the story is verse 6, where Yahweh visited his people in giving them food. Because of Yahweh's visitation, Bethlehem has again become what its name suggests, a house of bread. Yahweh's visitation brings more than a harvest of barley. At the same time Israel is beginning to reap the barley, Yahweh is beginning to reap in the Moabites. The Moabites who descend from the incestuous eldest daughter of Lot. The Moabites who seduced Israel as they came out of Egypt. Those Moabites are being gathered in because Yahweh has visited his people. They become a house of bread, a land of milk and honey. And the nations begin to stream in. He goes on to say this line, which I think is so key to reading this story and so key to making this the story of our lives. In the beginning and once upon a time, make rational sense as the beginning of a story. But recognizing a beginning on the other side of an end is an act of faith. See, what Naomi sees in her own story is the end. I'm undead. It's just a matter of time before the zombie stops moving. Get away from me. I'm contaminated. I'm radioactive. Go. But somehow, out of her last breath of sacrifice, a new sacrifice is born. And the story, which seems like it's at an end, comes to a new beginning. There's a feminist Jungian author who I was reading, and she says this: Ruth foreshadows Christ, the Redeemer, in her identifying with Naomi. The relic at the bottom of the heap, the remnant of the remnant. She allies herself with a single old woman who in a patriarchal society is without power or position. This is also what Jesus experienced, born in the muck of a stable in Bethlehem, where they returned to. Born in the muck of a stable, living his life with nowhere to lay his head, a constant example that God moves to the left out and forsaken parts of us to bring wholeness to all. Now, like, we could end here. Okay, let's go be like Ruth, right? There we go. Boom, end of sermon. But how does Ruth do it? It's because she sees an act of sacrifice. It's a wounded, sinful person who is still capable, even in the midst of self-condemnation, to produce sacrifice. M. Scott Peck, the famous sort of late 20th century kind of pop psychologist, says, wherever evil is overcome, wherever, there's always radical sacrifice. Why is that the case? Revelation 13:8 tells us that Jesus is the Lamb of God slain before the foundation of the world. So mysterious what that means. I think it means before he created you, he was already your Redeemer. That the act of creating you would involve the act of redeeming you, which would cost infinite sacrifice. And at the source of any finite true act of sacrifice is something, it's deeper magic, like C.S. Lewis talks about, that there's a deeper magic where an act of sacrifice undoes betrayal. So the key to making the story is an imitation of Ruth. The key is to know the one who someday Ruth's story will unfold into as part of the epic. It's to know the true Ruth. It's to know the true Ruth who becomes an immigrant, who leaves the comfort of his father's house and is born into Bethlehem in a stable and becomes frail and vulnerable and clings to you so that in the midst of the famine, you could by grace be fed. Amen.